From the New York City area, welcome to the Badass Counseling Show, where the master badass himself, Sven Erlandsson, takes you deep and gives balm for the soul, baby.
Hello, hello. You have found the Badass Counseling Show, and we are taping a lightning round just for you so that we could be stuck in your ear today. Mom used to say, if we were talking about you, were your ears burning? So if your ears are burning right now, it's because we're talking about you. Or you have that one disease that causes your ears to burn. It's one of those two. My name is Sven Erlandsson. I am the host of the Badass Counseling Show. I am joined in studio today by KC. That's a K and a C over there in the booth right over there. And I've got Rob the Rocket right next to me. Rob, what say ye?
Well, we got people checking in from all over while we're doing this taping of our podcast. And it's just exciting to see everybody with us. It's nice.
I agree. We have Nicaragua, we've got the UK, we've got Minnesota, we've got Italy, we've got somebody named Dorothea who dreams of having pizza in Massa Lubrense, and we've got people all over. We've got Beth in from Eagan, Minnesota, et cetera, et cetera. And we're going to start it right off with the first question of the night. First question of the night is, what do you think? This is from Timothy over on TikTok. And he says, what do you think about dating a recovered alcoholic with a past? The mere fact that you're asking that question says that you have fear, don't you, Timothy? You fear that this is going to be a problematic thing. And yet, what I find interesting about this is, would you be asking the question, would someone be asking the theoretical question of what do you think about dating someone who is a recovered alcoholic with a past, unless it would almost seem to indicate that there have been indicators in the relationship already, either that or the mere fact that they are a recovered alcoholic with a past scares you. And what I would really want to ask you, and I'm not going to be able to ask you because of the medium and the scrolling of questions on TikTok and Facebook and so forth, is what do you fear the most? I think you'd be wise, Timothy, to write that down. What precisely is it that I fear the most? I'm betting you fear some eventuality happening. Is it getting emotionally invested with this person and then they start drinking again? Or is it not the drinking, that they'll engage in some behavior pattern that would hurt your feelings, or you know, you'd have to break it up and then you know, all that you invested with your heart, you would lose? Or is it that you just dislike the idea of dating someone who has a past? Perhaps you fear people knowing that you're with someone who has a past. Without knowing that, it's hard to answer it, but you didn't ask any of those questions. You asked the question of what I think about dating a recovered alcoholic with a past. Well, I was dating a woman for a while, for quite some time, who had a past of her own, of drug addiction of her own. And in the tenure of our relationship, she was great. She was great. I mean, never a problem. There was no drug use, nothing. And she was a lovely person, really lovely person. Turns out we just fought a lot, and it wasn't because of her past or because of my past. It was just two people. Sometimes you get two people together and just the chemistry. It's not because one person's a bad person or the other person's a bad person. We just had bad chemistry. So my point to you is, Timothy, unless you are seeing indicators of a problem, I personally move forward, but just go step by step. You don't have to dive all in. Just take your time. But the other thing is, you have to, anytime you're going into a situation where you have trepidation, you have to protect your own self. And you have to insist on being treated well. And if you start allowing this person to mistreat you or take advantage of you or whatever it might be, then you're basically giving a permission slip to do those sorts of things. And then those things will continue. Next question. Psychological warfare from my narcissistic crush at work, who I won't interact with. How to turn her off? Now, that's an interesting question. That is actually like its own little puzzle trying to figure out, to be honest with you. And I know you have, when you people put in questions on TikTok, they get like not even 150 characters. They get like 100 characters or something. So it's like, try to be concise with a hard point in 100 characters. So I don't envy you that, Conker. But psychological warfare from my narcissistic crush at work. Okay, so either you have a crush on someone or someone who has a crush on you. But you state it as my narcissistic crush. So I'm assuming what you're saying is it's my crush and she's narcissistic. or he is, either way. No, you do use the word her. So I'm going to read it back, you guys, and let's try to figure this one out together. I'm going to ask your help on this one, Rob. KC, if you want to chime in, feel free. Psychological warfare from my narcissistic crush at work, who I won't interact with. How do I turn her off? Does that seem to imply that the narcissistic crush, that she's the narcissist crushing on him?
It seems self-contradictory to me.
It does. Why would you, if you have a crush on someone, why would you not want to interact with them except, of course, they're a narcissist? But I almost think he's saying, I don't know what to do here. We're spending a lot of time trying to
decide. She's got the crush on him, I think.
And she's a narcissist. And I won't interact with her. So how do you turn her off? Got it. That makes a lot more sense. That's more consistent.
I think so.
Occam's razor. Okay. So in this case, I'm going to assume that you have been bold. And if you haven't been bold, you need to be bold and just flat out state, I need you to please back off. And if you don't back off, I will have to go to human resources or I will have to report you and make it as an if-then. State it clearly, state it boldly, state it firmly, and you have to do it as an if-then. This is harassment in the workplace, and no one should have to endure that, not even a man. And then you have to be willing to follow through. Yes, does that upset the apple cart? Yes, is someone going to be mad at you? Yes, etc. All these things, but it's your own feeling of safety and enjoyment to your work, and just that you can get your freaking work done. But I would go to the person and be firm, and if you have already done that and they continue to do it, just go to HR. And HR has to protect you. It's their freaking obligation. All right, next question.
I do have a good question here, though,
if all right. You like it. If you got one coming over from YouTube, lay it on me.
I do. Is it possible I'm going from extreme giver to being an extreme taker? I feel like I've become very prideful since working on myself.
Yeah, being very prideful, proud of your work and proud of who you are. I don't know how that equates to being an extreme taker. And see, although, let's play with that. If a person has been an extreme giver, largely what they've been taught in their lifetime is that for you to give yourself love, you to do things for you, you to honor your own needs and wishes. In the past, if you had done that and you were around people who were extreme takers or who expected you to give, and then you took, you were probably told, oh my God, you're so selfish, all these things. The word selfish is like the scariest word to an extreme giver. Scariest word. It's the one that carries the most guilt. It's the one that will freeze an extreme giver in their tracks. Because aren't I being selfish if I wanna, you know, go out with my friends one night a month? No, you're not being selfish, you're being normal. But it really just feels so selfish. Shouldn't I be doing things? No! Okay, so then once you do the self work, and now, you know, and you're addressing all this stuff from your past. You're doing the self-help work or maybe with your therapist and you're addressing the stuff from the past. And I'm proud of my progress. I feel good. And I'm going to protect my borders. And, you know, I have every right to do what feels good to me. Well, that old belief system of you must be bad is still in you. So what do I think of that? I think your old belief system is still in you, antagonizing you from within, making you feel bad for finally creating a person that you originally were, that you could be proud of, your wonderful self, doing things for yourself. But clearly, you still have some of that old belief system in there because it's attacking you from within, saying, well, you must be an extreme taker. Oh, you're a narcissist. Oh, you're bad. So you still have some of those voices inside you. So what you need to do in your work is you need to go down deeper and find out, okay, whose voice is still antagonizing me? And what do I most fear by just being my authentic self? And I guarantee is that you have the fear of being attacked by those voices from your past that actually already are attacking you. So there's some more work there to do. And I would offer that the mere fact that you're asking these questions, but you're stating, I am proud of who I am. That's a huge statement of the progress you've made. And I really applaud you for that. You got my thumbs up on that. You got some more work here to do because that other voice is still attacking you from within.
He follows up, I've been told I'm more neglectful in my relationship lately, and that's where I've become scared.
Well, but here's the thing. And does he give a name with it?
Justin.
Justin, here's the thing. You've been told that you've become more neglectful in your relationship. Is this the same relationship, Justin, in which you were an extreme giver before? Because if you were an extreme giver and now you've changed, of course your partner's going to say, oh my God, what about my needs? You used to worship me all day, every day. You used to make it all about me. You used to give me everything. And now you're not. You don't love me. You're so neglectful. You're so selfish and neglectful, Justin, when it's a bunch of crap. You're finally creating an equitable relationship and you're being shamed for it. Rather than, my question to your partner would be, are you being objective in your assessment or are you being selfish in your assessment? And here's the thing, Justin, if you were an extreme giver in this relationship, then in all likelihood, your partner was some version of an extreme taker, in all likelihood, all right? And so if the person was an extreme taker, the last thing they want is you to start giving them less. The last thing they want is for you to start giving to yourself. The last thing they want is for you to expect them to give to you. I'll be straight up honest with you, Justin. I'll be shocked if your relationship lasts. And why? Because extreme takers very often don't like to change. In fact, most of the time, they don't like to change. And the only thing that causes them to change is pain, and usually in the form of loss, right? And so I'm betting what you're really wrestling with, Justin, is the choice between you and your partner. Do I really love myself? Do I love myself enough to stand up for myself or potentially walk away? Or am I still so wanting this partner that I'm willing to continue to subject myself, you know, to subjugate myself to this person at the expense of my own sense of self? So I don't doubt that you've done the work. I actually fully believe you, Justin. But if you've got someone who's wanting to keep you as old Justin, then you are in a dysfunctional relationship and you're being forced to choose, do I choose me or do I choose this person? Because clearly, if this person doesn't want to change and make the relationship healthier, then they're trying to push you to go back to choosing them all the time. All right.
Extremely effective counseling based on two sentences. My hat's off to you, Sven.
Well, thanks so much. Appreciate that. I'm probably full of shit on all of it. So I apologize, Justin, if I just fucked you up worse than you were beforehand.
He said, oof, that's heavy. Thank you.
All right. We'll take that as I did okay. All right. I like that. All right. So we've got... All right, Thomas Langley asked the question, have you ever had to evaluate your own relationship with alcohol, Sven? Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. Do you want to know what has driven me to drink too much at times in my life? In fact, it's really only been in my life, I've not been a huge drinker. I mean, you know, we blew our brains out in college, you know, but who doesn't in the later years of college? But never until like my late 40s, early 50s. And I went just through a period in my life where I was just really fucking bored. I was bored with my career. I was bored with life. It's like, I want to move faster. I want to go more and so on and so forth. And the boredom just kicked in. So everybody has their reasons. And so for me, the grand affliction of my life has always been boredom. And I definitely had to look into it. And for me, everybody's different, but for me, alcohol leads to eating. And that's always the problem for me. Why? Because I'm vain. I like looking good. And so when I drink, I eat and I eat and I eat and I eat too much. And so I'd be putting on weight and I wouldn't like the way I look. And so then my vanity is what's enabled me to cut back my drinking. So have I ever had to evaluate my own relationship with alcohol? Absolutely. You bet. And this is the thing, you guys, my counseling here, it's not just bullshit. And I respect all therapists who have the courage to do the work and they're in the trenches. And there's a lot of good therapists out there. There really, really are. And a lot of them gain a lot of knowledge and insight from books, but I don't have that. I got mine from real world experience, as a lot of therapists have too. Don't get me wrong. I don't mean to imply they don't. But most of the stuff, I only really talk about stuff that I've struggled with myself. Very important. Divorce, cheating, infidelity, pain, parenting, career, lack of motivation, suicide, all that stuff. I generally only touch stuff that I have, not entirely, but I generally only touch stuff that I've dealt with or is a close cousin of the stuff that I've dealt with. All right, personally. And of course, you know, counseling people for 30 years, so there's that as well. All right, next question. Francine Reed asked the question, what do you think has been the most rewarding work you've done as a counselor? And Francine is saying, I'm a future marriage and family therapist. My most rewarding work, and rewarding implies getting something back from it. Rewarding implies that it feels good. Rewarding implies that, you know, you make an investment and and something comes out the other end. Therefore, the most rewarding work I've done is the work I've done on myself. That I mined my own experience for all that it was teaching me about human nature, for all that it was teaching me about other people, and not just in terms of compassion. But I just had a person in medical school to be a psychiatrist reach out to me and talking about the counseling aspect of her work, asked me basically the exact same question. This was just like yesterday or something. And I said, the single biggest thing you can do to unleash your greatest power is heal your own shit as a therapist. Heal your own shit. You want to know why? Because you're going to get into counseling situations every single day. And you're going to question yourself, or you're going to be, maybe I shouldn't ask this question, or gosh, is this going to upset them? Or gee, I wonder what's really going on here, or what am I not getting? Or you're going to get distracted, or you're going to get bored, or whatever it is. Your own shit is going to infect the process. Therefore, the more work you do on your own past, of healing your own past, the bolder you are going to be. And good therapy requires boldness. Good therapy requires you having the balls to follow your own curiosity. When I am in session with someone, Rob and I just taped a session, a counseling session. It'll go up in the next couple of weeks with a person named Brenda. And we're in this session, and it was just kind of strange from the beginning. She was great. She was wonderful. But it was just, it was weird. And all I had was my own curiosity because I didn't have any story coming in. And you get, you know, I got 60 minutes to work with this person, 59, whatever. And I have to have the boldness to A, ask the hard questions and cut somebody off if I feel like it's not going anywhere. Because, I mean, if you only got 60 minutes or in most clients, you know, with their therapist, 50 minutes, 45 minutes, you don't have a lot of time to dick around. Well, I do 6-hour sessions with my clients, 4-hour sessions with my clients, and I still don't have time to dick around because I want to go as deep as I can. So you've got to be working on yourself so that you're not afraid to be bold. You're not afraid to cut them off. You're not afraid to press them. They're coming to you for results. But that also means you have to have the courage to be curious and go where your own brain is leading you, not where the client wants to lead. And what's always going to corrupt the process of you giving great therapy is your own shit. And it's identical. And most of you are thinking, what the fuck does this have to do with me? Why am I listening to Sven talk to some fucking therapist, like one person in the audience that's actually, you know, going to be a therapist or 20, one of 15 or whatever, because we get a lot on this show. But because it applies to your parenting, guys. It applies to your parenting, whether you have kids or going to have kids. It applies to your parenting. It's your own shit that is always corrupting your parenting. I was just telling a client today about, I've had many clients over the years who are, you know, being in Manhattan with my business, who are on Wall Street, who are literally CEOs on Wall Street, who run hedge funds, investment funds, that sort of thing. Do you want to know what's interesting? When I'm dealing with people who are dealing with investments, I say, well, if you're so successful, why the hell are you coming to me? And more often than not, it's some derivative of, Sven, because I'm off my game. And I tell them in advance, listen, I don't know shit from Shinola about business. I know even less about money or investments. It's, Sven, I'm not coming to you for that. I'm an expert in that. I'm not coming to you for that. I said, okay, then make it clear to me. Why are you coming to me? Because I want to get back on my game. What we find is that it's life, it's their own stuff from their past, it's their own stuff going on that causes them to distrust their own instincts. I've had professional gamblers, some you've even seen on TV. I had one gambler say to me, a professional, literally makes a living off it, say to me, Sven, I know if I sit down at a table, I know if I'm sitting down and I'm going to lose. I don't always know if I'm going to win, but I do know when I'm going to lose. I said, how do you know that? He says, because I'm forcing it. It feels off inside and I'm sitting down there and I know in advance I'm forcing it. I'm off my game. In other words, not tuned into your own instincts, not in tune to your real self. Well, it's the same with parenting. It's the same with investing. It's the same with artists that I've worked with. And so it's our own shit that gets in the way of doing our best work. So whether it be people in finance, whether it be parents, whether it be gamblers, whether it be future therapists, it's your own shit. You get that out and you will lock in. You will be operating from a place of centeredness. You'll be operating from a place of boldness and from a place of confidence. And you'll go where you need to go. And you won't be worrying about, oh, what about this and that and these fears and that fears. You got to do it aggressive. Go hard. All right. Next question. Here we go. I'm having trouble finding a therapist to understand past trauma with childhood and relationships, and I've been to several. That's interesting. I believe you. I fully believe you. Two things. One, I would encourage you to keep trying because there are ones out there that understand past trauma and childhood and relationships, and there are a lot of them, and there are a lot of good ones out there. So I would encourage you to keep trying. Unfortunately, what we are dealing with, at least in North America, is we are dealing with a mental health shortage. Accessibility, difficulties, and so forth. And this is so much of why I encourage people and tell people so much of this work you actually can do on your own. You really can, folks. I've created these 900 plus free videos on TikTok and Instagram and Facebook and YouTube. I've created those. Rob and I and KC invest a lot of time and energy into creating this free podcast. All of these are tools for you to do self-healing work. Even with my own clients, every single one of my clients knows that I assign homework. Every single one of my clients knows that they're expected to do work on their own. I don't scold them if they don't. But all the juicy work is done on your own. One of my favorite clients that I'm working with right now is a young woman in her 20s. And she is just, you know, she comes from a very tight and tough home and, you know, from down south. And just, you know, locked down tight, never allowed her feelings and so on and so forth. We've been working together for about a month and a month and a half. And she dropped me an email this morning. I actually had dropped her an email. I was up early and we had a session recently. And I said, hey, how you doing? That was a solid session. How you doing? She wrote me back and she said, Sven, I tell you what, I was euphoric after our session for probably the first time in almost probably all of my life. And she said, and the journaling is working and these tools, these other tools that you're teaching me is really working. And then she said this, she said, I'm looking forward to my next pain so that I can get it out of my system and feel that euphoria and feel that, what was the word she called? Feel that relief again. For a client who didn't even have language for feelings, who wasn't allowed feelings, to say something, a young woman saying, I look forward to my next pain so that I can get the relief that comes after it. That's fucking progress. And that's the exciting part. The point is what? You can be doing this shit on your own. Now, she's doing it with me, but the point is, I've created these tools. I wrote the book. There's a hole in my love cup. Why? Because I didn't have anyone helping me through my 12-year suicidal depression. You can do this shit on your own. I am telling you, you can do this shit on your own. A great therapist can be a great help, but if you can't find one, do it on your own. I've created these tools. There's the English, there's the Spanish version, and you can do this, but you have to have the courage to go into it and go deep. And then the other book, Badass Wisdom, which is a daily meditational asking you the deep questions to keep you in it after you've done There's a Hole in My Love Cup. We are going to take more questions right after this short break.
You've heard Sven talk a lot about his book, There's a Hole in My Love Cup, and that's because Sven hears from his followers a lot about how much the book has helped them. If you're not sure how to handle the issues getting in the way of a better life, you're not alone, and you have a lot of choices. But thousands of readers will tell you that this is a great place to start, by yourself and at your own pace. So go to badasscounseling.com and order There's a Hole in My Love Cup, and you'll have Sven right there with you as you forge your best future. It's totally badass. So get started today.
This show provides soul counseling intended to entertain and inform and is not medical advice. Now, back to the badass.
We're back with more questions. I've got a follow-up from Thomas, who had asked the question earlier and said, Sven, I read your book and didn't do the work, so I've leaned into my vices more. Thank you for the advice on booze. I can't even tell you the number of times I hear people say, hey, Sven, you know, I got your book. I read your book. I'll even get people who come to me in session. And my assistant, Kate, is always telling clients, you know, you're expected to read the book or be reading the book before you start. And so people have at least started it or they're midway through or whatever. And the reason I want them to read the book is because this is 80% of my counseling method in one book. So we can move much, much faster in session. But I routinely get people saying, Sven, I read the book, but I didn't do the exercises. Or, you know, gee, I didn't do the journaling stuff and so on and so forth. And very often what that is a person who doesn't want to touch the real shit. They can take in the insights and they appreciate that. But the interface, they'll say, oh, I have troubles journaling. No, they don't have troubles journaling. You know, they know how to use a pen and paper. No, it's they don't want to touch the real shit of their own self. And this is the critical juncture, you guys, when it comes to counseling. You can do all of your self-healing work. You can heal yourself on your own. You really can. But the linchpin of it all is you have to have the willingness to go into. You don't have to know how to do it all. That's what my tools are for. And there are a lot of great other self-help books. I opened my book by listing 9 other self-help books that are not by me that you can use as tools that I recommend all the time to my clients because there are great tools out there. So you don't have to know how to get there. You have to have the willingness to go into the shit and feel the fucking pain. If you don't have that, even a great therapist ain't going to be able to help you. I can't help somebody who's locked down. All right. So you got to be willing to do the work. All right. Sven, I'm part of a book club and we are reading your book. And love how you put into perspective life and God. We love that we can all relate. That's great. I wish you had a question. I'd be glad to help you or whomever with a question. All right. Jonathan says, here we go. Rob, I think this is a first.
Let's have it.
Jonathan says, you ever think about starting a cult? No, I haven't thought about that. But now that you put it in my head, let's get going on that. Jonathan, you can head up the committee. All right, next question.
I got a question over here, if you'd like.
Go ahead, Rob.
All right, here's a guy who is 20 years younger than his brother. And he says, his brother went through a false domestic violence accusation when I was a kid, and he's never really been the same since. He has a daughter he rarely gets to see. He's really fallen. The question is, what can I do as someone so much younger to help guide him out of where he is right now?
What's his name?
Teddy.
Teddy, it really goes to what I was talking about just a minute ago when I was saying, even if I'm in session with someone, even if you're in session with a therapist, if you don't want to open up, there's nothing the therapist can do. There's really nothing they can do. And it sounds like your brother doesn't want to open up. He stayed in this lockdown state. Teddy, your love for your brother is obvious, and it's beautiful, and I love you for it, man. Wanting to help your brother, wanting to pull him out of it. And unless your brother is willing to, there's really not a lot you can do. Well, that raises the question, well, is there something I can do to make him willing to? Now, that's the question. And what you can do to do your best, to at least lay the foundation. He may never walk through the door, all right, and allow you to help him. But the one thing, I'm reminded of what my mother always used to say. She would often counsel. She counseled many people. She did what I do long before I did. She died at the age of 93 a few years back. And because her husband was clergy and because my mother was taught at the graduate level in the field of early childhood and also ran large education programs of large churches, she had a lot of people that she counseled, including pastors' wives, particularly young pastors' wives. They're coming out of seminary, and she would often get them coming to her and, you know, seeking her counsel because she had been a pastor's wife for decades and decades, and she'd take them through their issues and so on and so forth. And one of the questions she would tell that regularly came up from these young pastors' wives is, you know, Charlotte, I'm so scared. What should I do? There's so much pressure on the pastor's family and there's so much pressure on the pastor's wife. And it's true. It's life in a fishbowl, right? And mom would always respond to this. And she even gave this as parenting advice to struggling parents. She would say simply this, just love them. Sometimes life's not a grand formula. And for mom, just love them meant bring kindness. You got to be firm at times, but bring kindness. What your brother needs is your love. What he needs more than anything, the one thing you can give him, you may not ever be able to pull your brother out of this. You may not ever be able to help your brother have the courage to purge all of his pain and all of his fear and all of his heartbreak at distance from his own child. All the pain of being falsely accused. It's horrible. Nobody should have to go through that. It's horrible, and I feel horrible for your brother. I feel horrible for you. The best you can do is just keep loving your brother, caring for him, you know, doing stuff with him. And if the moment comes where he opens up the door, and you can even bring that up, you know, would you be interested in counseling? Don't do it soon, unless you've already been loving on him a while. And don't push hard because then he'll push you away because he'll feel like you have an agenda. Just love him, brother. He needs that more than anything, to know that he has someone who doesn't judge him and that loves him no matter what. Next question. Nate Thompson. If it's the Nate I know, Nate went to a very conservative college and he had his days after a very conservative college of not so conservative living. And I love him for it. Miss him. And he says, is the book better than Rescuing God from Christianity, which is one of my former books? Yes, this is it's very powerful and it'll help you heal if you have the courage to do the work. And it's become an international bestseller, as you can see by the cute little medal on the Spanish version of the book, indicating that it is a bestseller. All right, next question. Michelle asks the question, can you talk about using the audiobook as reinforcement of the paper book content? Basically what Michelle is asking, or what she's indicating, pointing out, is that there are audiobook versions of a couple of my books. Rob and I are working on taping a third of Rescuing God and Badass Jesus. And what she's asking is, talk about the idea of using the audiobook as reinforcement of the paper book content. You can. You're not required to. The audiobook comes with a free PDF that has all of the questions and journaling prompts and so on and so forth. So you can do the audiobook and still have all the paperback, all the questions there on paper to answer and keep up with and do in writing. Do I feel that it's necessary to have the audiobook as reinforcement of the paperback content? Necessary? No. Could it be very helpful? Yes. Why? Because obviously, because then you can listen to your favorite stuff when you're driving to work. You can listen to it and then sit down and read it when you're sitting next to the fireplace or out in the woods with the paperback version. So yes, definitely getting both could definitely help you, but it is in no way necessary. All right. All right. Go ahead, Rob.
All right. This is from YouTube, from Delano, who says, apparently this person's in a lot of pain, Sven. Sven, how do I avoid giving my children divorce trauma? They're 10 years old and 2 years old. I would feel guilty for breaking up my family and asking for a divorce. But my ex lied and cheated for 10 years, and I don't want to co-parent.
Yeah, okay, and that's fine. But aren't you fundamentally co-parenting now? And not even the question. The opening statement sounds like it's the primary point. You're ending with, I don't want to co-parent, but you open with, I don't want to pull the family apart and hurt my 10 and 2-year-old. Is that accurate, Rob?
Yes.
Okay. So I would ask you first, if we were in session, I'd ask you, what's your biggest fear? Is it the co-parenting or is it hurting your 10 and 2-year-old? And then if you likely said it's hurting my 10 and 2-year-old, I'm willing to bet. Then I would ask you the question, well, what's your fear? Hurting them, or is it possible your fear is them being mad at you? Now, with a 2-year-old, it's unlikely. 10-year-old, possible. All right. But fear of hurting the child. This, if you're not having this fear when you're getting a divorce, then you're one cold motherfucker. All right. I'm glad you're having that fear. That's good that you're having that fear. But the bottom line is, I'm very adamant in this. My belief over 30 years of counseling people and having been divorced when my kids were very young, I'm a believer in divorcing when the children are young rather than when they are old. I really believe that. I honestly believe that the chance for recovery is better when the child is young because they have longer to normalize it. More importantly, or just as importantly, yes, if you divorce, it's going to hurt your children. And I actually have a video, I've taped it. I taped it just this morning or yesterday. I haven't put it up yet, on the impacts of divorce. And I had a client tell me what so many people don't realize in divorce is once the divorce papers are signed, the burden of the divorce shifts onto the children. Multiple holidays, having to tell your story about the good thing that happened at school to more than once, the multiple parents, having to watch out for this parent's feelings or not, you don't want to say anything bad about, you know, or good about dad when mom's around or and that sort of thing. Having to tell medical news or sports accomplishments multiple times that you fundamentally, to a large degree, become responsible for managing the family. And then my client said, and let alone you then bringing two more dysfunctional people. So now we got four dysfunctional adults in this family. It would have been heaven sent if it had just been left at two dysfunctional adults. What am I getting at? What I'm getting at is, if you are divorcing, regardless of the age of your children, and this is prior to answering your question, what I'm getting at is you have a responsibility as a parent to be the fucking parent. Be the parent. Take some responsibility. Don't put the onus onto your children. Now, that may seem then to you asking about, gee, should I get a divorce? I don't want to get a divorce, but he's been cheating on me for 10 years, blah, blah, blah. No, I'll be very honest with you. If you were my client, I would have advised you to get the hell out of that relationship about 2 years ago or 8 years ago when the cheating started. Why? You're not doing your children any favor. You think that by not breaking up the family, you're doing them a favor. What? Think of all that you're teaching them by staying in a relationship such as this. Your children are sensing the coldness of their home. You are teaching them that this is what love is. You are teaching them that this is what it means to be an adult. Your unhappiness, not just in the relationship, but in your life, that your unhappiness, that this is normal. You are normalizing this as a version for how to live. You are normalizing this as a version for what love looks like. You are normalizing that this is how a woman treats a man. You are normalizing this is how a man treats a woman. Furthermore, do you really think your children don't pick up on the fact that you two don't love each other? Do you really think they don't pick up on the fact that you're unhappy or that dad's unhappy? They're picking up on all of it. They are sponges. They're seeing it all. They're feeling it all. They may not be able to verbalize it yet, but they're seeing and feeling it. So I'm just going to tell you, from my experience, my bias is get the divorce. Figure out how to co-parent. Make it work. And you two have to commit to doing what's in the best interest of the kids. But I do not believe that staying together for the kids is a help. You want to know why? Because they're going to get to college age when you decide to finally break it to them. And so they're going to be off in, you know, they're going to be off in some other state. They're off in Butte, Montana, or they're down in Atlanta going to college or working their first job in Chicago. And they're not there. And then you're going to break it to them. And who are they surrounded by? They're surrounded by their knucklehead friends. Do you want to know how much their knucklehead friends know about teaching them how to and loving them and walking them through their parents divorcing? The two most important people in your children's lives are now separating and getting a divorce. It'll break your kids' hearts. And you're doing it when they're off at college, when their lives are supposed to be taking off, but you're doing it now when their life is taking off. And so now it's their burden. So now their life can't take off. But if you do it now when they're 2 and 10, they have lots of time in a structured setting surrounded by people that love them to sort through this and get all their pain out and to work on creating a new sense of normal and working through their issues in a controlled laboratory setting, so to speak. But if you tell them later, I had a client, I've told you guys this before, I had a client who was 26 years old, she was about to get married, and she says, yeah, my parents sprung their divorce on me 6 months before our wedding. Yeah. Thanks, mom and dad, that's great. She said, Sven, I hated my wedding. Not because mom and dad were shits. I was just fucking miserable. It just fucking destroyed me for about 5 years. Thanks, guys. Appreciate that. Yeah, that was a great idea to wait and spring it on me right before the wedding. Yeah, I'm a big fan of doing it early, doing it soon. And anybody who thinks, oh, it'll affect kids worse when they're young, they'll have a greater chance to recover. And furthermore, the impact you are having by staying in a loveless marriage is far more profound, because guess what kind of relationship your kids are going to choose when they get to be 15? They're going to choose a marriage where somebody treats them like shit, not a marriage, a dating relationship. Somebody treats them like shit, or they'll just do anything to be loved. Or guess what kind of relationships they're going to choose when they're adults? They're going to choose something that looks almost identical to what you chose, or they're going to choose the opposite because they're so disgusted by how they were raised. And unfortunately, sometimes the opposite of shit is still shit. All right, I'm going to take one last question, and then we're going to call it a day. Have you got one, Rob, that you're itching for? If not, I have some here.
It's up to you. I have one. The person said, sorry for the typos, but I think I can interpret it for you. It's
all right.
Up to you.
Go ahead.
All right, let's try it. This is from Ross. I'm dating a woman with 4 kids who is dealing with her NPD, divorced. How do I comfort her when she's going through a tough time? She's been dealing with him for 4 years after the divorce, and I treat them like my own kids and love them and her. NPD, you understand that?
Narcissistic personality disorder.
Okay.
I'm not going to address that, though, because I am not a therapist. I'm not a psychologist. I'm a soul counselor, so I'm not going to touch that. But I will touch the question apart from that. And so, Rob, basically what I'm hearing is, how do I support my spouse going through a divorce, has issues of her own, has 4 kids. I love these fucking kids, doing my best. What can I do to support her?
Yeah, it's been 4 years since the divorce.
It's been 4 years. And does he indicate what the grandest struggle or the hardest part of this whole thing is?
Doesn't say.
Okay. It's just like anything, to be very honest with you, what you can do is keep delivering the goods and keep loving on the kids. And keep loving on your spouse and being there for the spouse. However, that being said, if they're dealing with narcissistic personality disorder, you know, you and I both know that what means what? Extreme taker, right? And so your antennae should be going up. And it's basically, you got to protect yourself though, daddy-o. You got to protect yourself. You got to have your boundaries, and you don't exist to serve the interests, solely to serve the interests of another person. They exist to serve yours as well. So you got to have your boundaries. You got to have your no. And if you feel taken advantage of, well, then you got to put that to an end. You got to stop feeling taken advantage of, and you have to stand up for yourself. And especially, the demands are great if you got somebody with, you know, high demands, but also there's 4 kids. It would be very easy for you to get lost in the whole shuffle. You can't allow that. You want to know why? Because in about a year, in about 4 years, in about 14 years, you're going to be fucking miserable if you're not already. In fact, you even posing that question says that potentially, yeah, you're wanting to support your spouse, but also there must be some sort of agony inside of you. Otherwise, you wouldn't have posted a question at all. There must be something deep that you're struggling with. And yes, it may be how to support your spouse going through all this, but that is almost a greater tell to me.
He's dating her.
Dating her.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would be very careful, my man. I would be very careful about getting sucked down the rabbit hole of making it all about her. You need to check your six. And that is, you need to all keep an eye on monitoring your own levels of energy so that your giving is coming from a place of giving and not from a place of desperation or fear that this person may not love me. And you need to also check, is it roughly in the beginning of any relationship, is the giving roughly on a one-to-one exchange ratio? Roughly, right? So if you're investing into this investment, this bank account, so to speak, this emotional bank account between with another person in the beginning of a relationship, if you're investing at a rate of 4 to 1, you invest 4 parts to every one of theirs, or you're investing 3 to every 1 of theirs, or you're investing 5 to every 2 of theirs, we are seeing an uneven distribution of energy, distribution of or investment of love and time and energy. You're investing more. And guess what? You are laying the pattern for the rest of the relationship. If you're starting at a 5-to-2 ratio where you're investing 5 and they're investing 2, you know, emotional investments or doing things for the other person or listening to the other person or being kind. If you're investing at 5-to-2, give it about 3 years and you'll be at the ratio of about 15-to-4. And over time, you'll be at a ratio of about 50-to-1. All right. You have to check that because you can't come back later and say, holy shit, I'm in this full blown flying shit show circus of, madness with this woman. And, you know, it's totally crazy. And she's an extreme taker. Now is when you have the chance to catch it. Go ahead, Robert.
They have been together for 4 years since the divorce.
All right. And so then let me ask. Well, then, yeah, you just got to watch your six and you got to keep an eye on whether or not you're over-investing in the relationship. And you know what? The mere fact that you're not married is A, a good thing, but B, it says that also you're still in the beginning of a relationship, because I've literally had clients say, my spouse changed the day after the wedding, or my spouse changed a year into it. And so you're never not in the beginning of a relationship. Really, you've always got to be vigilant that you don't start letting someone treat you like shit. And that can start at any point in the relationship, even 4 years in. All right. Rob, any final thoughts before we shut this particular episode down?
Nope. Lots of good comments. Lots of supportive people out there.
All right. I'm going to finish on this one. I'm going to do one more right here. And it's simply this. Sharia Upton asks this question. She says, I'm curious of your credentials as I am a licensed therapist. And I always love this question. I love this question because I love to be fully fucking transparent. I am not a psychologist. I am not a licensed therapist of any sort whatsoever. I am a soul counselor, former pastor. I've had a soul counseling practice for 30 years, including the last 10 in Manhattan, New York City. I do not address psychology. I don't touch it. I stay in my lane. I go deeper. Down to the soul issues, down to the core beliefs. I'm about belief systems and I'm about pain. And this is what I deal in. I don't touch psychology. As you saw tonight with the NPD thing, don't touch it. So if you want a psychologist, there are a lot of great ones out there. You want a psychiatrist, some amazing ones out there. Many of them are clients of mine. You want some great therapists, there are great therapists out there. Wonderful ones. And once again, for those of you who are asking, and there are a few coming up, my latest books are Badass Wisdom, which is a 366-day meditational inspirational book, and There's a Hole in My Love Cup, the international bestseller. All right, and you can get them both and all the rest of my books at badasscounseling.com. This has been a great show. Thank you. On behalf of KC, on behalf of Rob the Rocket, thank you so much for tuning in to yet another interesting lightning round of the Badass Counseling Show. Have a kick-ass day.
The Badass Counseling Show is strictly copyrighted. No copies may be made without the express written consent of the Badass Counseling Show, LLC. The Badass Counseling Show is produced by Karen Camparelli and Robert H. Friedman. Executive producer, Sven Erlandson. Original music by 2-time Emmy Award-winning composer, Trevor Morris. Have a kick-ass day.